All right.
Yeah.
So today, I forgot to write down the number, but I think it's Mitzvah 532. Single document, 532. So we're moving along. Today is what I would consider a little more difficult mitzvah for us to understand. It's something that's very foreign to us in our modern society, but we'll try to explain how it does relate to us and how it does make sense. This mitzvah is the whole procedure called Eishes Yefas Toar, which we'll explain in detail, obviously, but it means that a person in battle is attracted to an attractive woman on the enemy side. That's how it all starts. So Eishes Yefas Toar, the words mean a woman who is of a pretty appearance, an attractive woman. So it's a procedure which the Torah prescribes, we'll see, only for those who really need it. We'll tell you what it is. It might seem to us at first glance somewhat, obscure, maybe inhumane, but we'll see how it actually does make a lot of sense as we go through it. The Torah the mitzvahs of the Torah are supposed to be considered entirely true, entirely compassionate, and even when we see mitzvahs that we feel are a little bit obscure or maybe a little bit difficult to understand, we always have to put them into the right context to understand them. So we're going to attempt today to put this into the right context and understand what it actually means, even on a practical note for us. So let's get the facts down as usual. Let's get down one of the rules of this mitzvah, and then we'll go to try to understand more of the meaning behind it. So this is the beginning of Parshas Ki Tsetse. This is the book of Dvarim, chapter 21, and it begins at verse 10. So it says that you go out to war against your enemies, and Hashem gives them into your hands, so you're victorious. V'shavisa shivyon, you take captives. So they fight a war, they have a victory, and they take captives. And then verse 11 says, V'isa b'shivyo, you see amongst the captive people, Eishes Yefas Toar, the beautiful woman, V'chashakta ba, you desire her, and you take her as a wife. So it says that there's some method, we'll see, of taking a captive woman to become a wife. Then it says, Avesel toch besech, you bring her into your home. Gilcha es rosha, you shave her head. Vasa siparnean, you allow her nails to grow out. This is a month-long procedure. You remove from her the clothing she was wearing, before when we were at war, and you give her plain clothing, and she dwells near her house, and she cries over her family for a month. So, she just went through a very emotional experience. There was a big war, she was taken as a captive, her family is left behind somewhere if they're still alive. So she says she cries for her mother, her father and her mother for a month. After that, you have permission to be intimate with her and take her as a wife. So that's the short description of the Torah. And then it says, and if you don't desire her, after this procedure occurs, the man does not want to marry her, you send her free. You may not sell her as a slave or a worker because you have already tormented her. And then that's the end of the discussion. So very interesting procedure, something very unfamiliar to us. But let's get the details straight. So number one is that there's a soldier who's at war, and they're taking captives. Which, in our days, that's not, it still is done sometimes, but that was something very commonplace in war. All the commentaries point out, and you see it in the Torah itself, that in those days, it wasn't uncommon for women on the enemy's side to dress up and try to attract the enemy men. And for obvious reasons, because you attract the enemy soldier, you can convince him, you can kill him, you can get some secrets out of him. Women have a lot of power. So it wasn't an uncommon thing for the enemy women to actually proactively try to attract the enemy men. We actually find this in the Torah itself explicitly when the Jews when the Midianite women came out to try to attract the Jewish men, and they sinned because of it. So you do find that in the Torah itself, and that wasn't an uncommon practice.
Who sinned, the Mennonite women or the men?
The Midianite women attracted the Jewish men, and then the Jewish men sinned with these women. So you do find that in the Torah itself, that practice, and it wasn't an uncommon practice in ancient times. So these women may have been dressed, so you might picture a woman at war as not necessarily dressed in her finest garb, but in those days it actually wasn't uncommon for them to be dressed up in their finest garb at war to try to attract these men. So they went out to attract the men. There was an attractive woman amongst the captives. So the Torah says he has the right to take her as a wife, but only after the following procedure. There's a whole procedure that must be done. So you can't just say, okay, I'm taking you, you're mine, and force a marriage and be finished. There is a procedure. If you complete the procedure properly, then you have the right to take her as a wife. So what exactly is this procedure? So number one There's a big debate amongst the Rishon, the early commentators, if it's permitted for this man to be intimate with the woman initially at war, meaning that first time they meet and he feels attracted, are they allowed to have intimacy or not? That's a debate. Rashi says no, the Rambam says yes. So that first time is a debate what happens. But after that first moment, he has to bring her home to his own house. So he can't put her in some, you know, prisoner of war camp. He can't put her out, you know, in the shed. I mean, he has to take her into his home. He has to shave her head and grow out her nails. And we'll see more, but the point of that is you want to make her look unattractive, make her look unkempt. Because you'll see this procedure, a lot of it is to try to dissuade him from taking her as a wife. Meaning, we don't want people to take wives because they had an attraction at war. That's not an appropriate marriage. That's not a marriage which the Torah would recommend. So the procedure is that you want to take away her beautiful looks temporarily to see, do you really want to marry her after that? Because we don't think this is going to be a very productive marriage. You know, to marry some non-Jewish woman that you saw on the battlefield just because you're attracted to her that one time, that's not what the Torah prescribes marriage to be. So you let her. So for a month, she shaves her head, grows out her nails. She changes from her attractive clothes to plain clothes. And then she has to stay in his house where he will, Rashi explains, see her constantly. She's going to be there in the house. He's going to come in and out every single day and see her in her unattractive state. So, and this goes on for 30 days. It's actually pointed out, which is even stranger to us, this soldier may already have been married, and he has a wife at home too. So I don't know what she's going to say about this whole procedure either, which also would be a very big motivation not to get married to this Eshes Hefas Tohar. But this is a 30-day situation. And for 30 days, she sits there mourning her situation. As we said, she cries over her father and mother, the Torah says. She has to mourn for 30 days in this man's house in her unattractive state. So if after all this, he still wants to marry her, 30 days have passed, he's gone through the whole procedure, and he still wants to marry this woman. So the Rambam says that now after 30 days, we see if she wants to convert. I mean, she's not Jewish. So we're not sanctioning an intermarriage with this. And she was captured from an enemy army. So the Rambam says, after 30 days, you have to see if she wants to convert. If she wants to convert, then she converts and he can marry her. If not, so then she's dealt with as we deal with any sort of non-Jew. If she's idolatrous, she has to deal with those consequences. If she's just a regular old Noahide who wants to believe in God but not be Jewish, then she dealt with him that way. But she has that option at that point. After 30 days passed, she has the option, do you want to convert or not? If she chooses to convert, he marries her. And if not, she's set free and you deal with her. And the Rambam says there could be a 12-month process of convincing her to convert, possibly. But after that process, she's dealt with, you know, as we deal with any other non-Jew, based on her beliefs. Rashi says that he's actually allowed to marry her, to convert her against her will, which is very unique. We don't do that typically. Yeah. This is a unique situation. Where she could actually coin her, again, it's a dispute. Rambam says not. But Rashi says you can convert her against her will and then marry her. So this is part of that big dispute of Rashi and the Rambam, how this whole mitzvah plays out. But this is one unique situation, at least according to Rashi, where we would actually perform a forced conversion, which is, again, it goes very much against what we're used to. This is an exceptional rule, as we'll talk about more why it's exceptional. If he decides not to marry her, again, which is part of the goal, we don't want him to marry her. This is considered a not an ideal situation. We'd rather him not marry her because, as you can tell, it's not the ideal. It wasn't a very very nice situation the way that they dated and met, etc. So, if he decides not to marry her, as we hope, then he has to set her free. He can't sell her as a slave. Can't keep her captive. Can't work her. Sets her free. She's on her own and finished. So those are the details of the mitzvah. So again, the procedure is interesting. It's not what we're used to. But I want to put this all into context. When you put it into context, it makes a lot more sense. And the Gemara discusses it at length. The different commentaries discuss it at length. And with this discussion, we can understand more where this mitzvah is coming from. So let's start back with something we discussed a few weeks ago. We discussed, I think, it was probably, I don't know, a couple months ago, the sanctity of the Jewish army. We discussed the idea that the soldiers in the Jewish army in the times of the Torah were only the most righteous soldiers. When they went to fight a war, we had the special Kohen would get up and give a speech and send home all those people that were scared of the sins they had on the record. We knew we needed God's help at war, and therefore that people who remained in the army were the most righteous of the Jews. That's number one. Additionally, we discussed the sanctity of the Jewish army camp. Now, we discussed the idea the camp has to be a pure place, People did not leave their waste around. They had to carry around special shovels to cover up their excrement. It was had to be a very pure, clean place, because the Jewish army camp was not based on the military strategy that they had. It was based on the help of God. So it was a place of prayer. It was a place of sanctity. And the people who fought were righteous people. That was the picture of the Jewish army in the times of the Torah. And that carried on really through on the times of, in Eretz Yisrael in the times of the First Temple. And that's our starting point. So these people who we're talking about in this situation, the likelihood is hopefully they won't even fall into this mess that we're discussing. Because hopefully they'll have some standards of morality and self-control to say, even though I see attractive women of the enemy army, that's not going to make me want to go and go further with it. So that's our first, that's square one of this entire picture, to understand who these soldiers were that we're speaking of.
Isn't there an issue in terms of the grade of the person, the grade of the Yetzer Hara? And we see that in the Gemara, like Rav Chiya going up on the attic and the things where the woman...
It's true, but also we do hope the greater the person, the more self-control they have. I mean, it goes both ways. You're right. But you know, overall, we understand that a person who's a tzaddik, he has built himself up to that point, and he has that self-control. So this entire halacha, the Gemara says, is not the ideal. I mean, we don't recommend it to be done. You're not supposed to do it. We shy away from it. But this is a desperate measure for desperate times, basically. You know, desperate times need desperate measures, they say. And the Gemara says that we're talking about a person who, despite everything else, he is falling prey to his own personal lusts and desires. The Gemara says, "Lo dibra Torah el kenegad Yitzhara." This entire halacha is there because Yitzhara has already trapped the guy. I mean, Yitzhara has already told this guy, you know, your lusts are going to overcome you. You've been overpowered by your passion and your desire for this woman, and basically, he's lost self-control. So obviously, square one is the guy should have self-control, and we recommend having self-control and not falling into this entire procedure. But the Yetzer Hara has his ways. You know, people have their challenges, and sometimes, in a time of war especially, when things are a little more loose, a little more lawless, people can lose themselves. Unfortunately, we see it to this very day. You know, we've spoken about recently also the idea of, you know, at wartime, things do become very, very loose in terms of property, in terms of morality. The Jewish army tries to really put a cap on that and tries to make sure that we're careful with everything else around, despite the fact that we're at war. But bottom line, I'm talking about human beings. It's a reality of life that people are going to have this type of attraction, and therefore it's ours to deal with it. You know, this is actually really the one place in the Torah that you see clearly that the Torah is looking at somebody who's at the verge of failure and trying to work with that failure. I mean, this is not a most mitzvos or what you are supposed to be doing with your life. You know, you're supposed to be acting this way, refraining from that. This mitzvah is that you've already fallen into an immoral state of mind. You're already about to do something which is an inappropriate act. So let's at least, you know, salvage what we can and make it better. That's where this whole mitzvah comes in. It's a very unique mitzvah in that sense. That's why it says this mitzvah is being spoken about connected to Yitzhara. This mitzvah is here to, I guess, go with the Yitzhara or counteract it in some way because you're already falling prey to it. That's how we understand it. So we're talking about a man, basically he's already at the verge of sin. And there's no turning back at this point. So the Torah says, so what can we do with him? He's already at the verge of a sin. And he's just going to go and grab this woman. So how can we at least take that moment and help to sanctify it and make it something that could fit into the realm of Jewish life? And that's where the mitzvah starts. So by no means does the Torah recommend going to war and grabbing captive women and bringing them home. That's not what the mitzvah means. It means that you've already lost yourself. You're already gone. You're already going to do the sin. And therefore, let's try at least salvage the person with his base instincts and try to make it at least somewhat of an acceptable act. That's where we're starting. The Gemara uses a metaphor. The Gemara says, it's better for you to eat a slaughtered piece of meat from a sick animal than an avela, an animal that died without slaughter. I mean, either way, it's a sick animal. Eating it's not healthy for you. But at least slaughter it before you eat it, so it's kosher. But if you just let it die and it doesn't get the kosher shchita, then it's treif. So either way, you're doing something which is bad for you and is not healthy, but at least try to do what you can to kosherize it rather than, you know, even though it's unhealthy, it's a kosher unhealthy act, then let it just die and become an avela. That's the metaphor given. So to here, the act is going to occur one way or the other. The guy has already lost himself to the most base desires. And therefore, the Torah recognizes that this person now has lost control let's give him a framework in which he can channel this desire in a more appropriate way. So that's our starting point. So the battle is already lost. I mean, not the battle against the enemy, the battle against himself has already been lost. We know in general, this is the Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos, the Mishnah says that who's the true gibor, who's the true hero? The person who's able to overcome his Yetzer Hara, Kovish is Yitzro. So this guy may have defeated an enemy army, but he can't overpower himself. The famous line from the Chovos HaVavos, the duties of the heart. And he says that there was once a story that a soldier came back from war, and he was approached by the Chacham, by the sage. And the sage told him, no, you've won the small battle, but now you have to fight the bigger battle. Bigger battle being overcoming yourself. That's the bigger battle. So this person over here may have overcome the small battle, the enemy army, but he wasn't able to overcome his bigger battle than himself to control his own personal desires. But we see here, I think, which I think itself is a very important idea, even when our standards may fall, even when we're in situations that are compromising, even then, there have to be some standards. There has to be red lines. Even when you cross a red line, there has to be another red line. You know, there has to be something to salvage, even when you're doing something wrong. I mean, people have to have at least, you know, some people think, once I fail, so then I just give up. But the Torah is saying that this guy, we look at him as someone of a failure. But even then, there is something you can do to salvage yourself and not fall into a deeper mode of failure. I once heard someone describe, it's not the simple meaning of the verse, but at least the message is there. You know, the Torah says, "Ervas achi avicha lo segale." It's talking about the idea of incest. And it says, you should not uncover the nakedness of your uncle. The Torah is speaking to a man. So if you're speaking about an uncle and a man, it's homosexuality. So the Torah forbids homosexuality by itself. And then it tells the guy, and also, not your uncle. So I once heard someone explain, so who are we talking to there? We're talking to the homosexual who's already involved in homosexual acts. And we tell him, okay, at least draw a line at your uncle. You know, so even though you're already violating one rule of the Torah, so you've already broken the Torah standards, at least draw a red line somewhere. You know, so at least not your uncle. And that's I've heard someone explain that pasuk that way before, which is the same message, that you know, even though you have fallen and you're doing acts the Torah looks at as inappropriate, you've given in to your own desires, even in that state, there are standards. You know, even broken standards need some form of standards. You have to have that somewhere along the way. So that's the framework of this mitzvah. So much of the procedure is really to discourage the marriage, because we don't look at this as appropriate marriage. It's not the way that it should be done. So she sits there for a month in his house, in an unattractive state, wearing basic plain clothing, her head shaven, her nails growing out long, and the man's going to walk by her every single day, and he's going to say to himself, I was so attracted to her at war when she was all dressed up, but do I have that same feeling towards her now? And keep in mind, they have no emotional connection. I mean, they never actually really had any sort of interaction beyond the wartime and maybe the physical interaction, but that was all they had. So there's no emotions, there's no connection, there's no called chemistry, as they say. There's no nothing there. All he had was a physical attraction, and now he sees her unattractive. And Rashi points out, which I think for us should be obvious, that if they did get married, it's very likely doomed to failure. Because as we know, Rashi says that, you know, Rashi has sources for this, and he says that eventually he'll come to hate the woman, and even if they give birth to children, the children will be rebellious children, which is the next part of the Torah discusses the rebellious child, which we'll talk about next week, God willing. So this marriage is doomed to failure, and any offspring are doomed to be rebellious, you know, kids who can't control themselves either. So it's not a very good situation. And it's the message to us that any marriage built just on physical attraction, that doesn't create a peaceful marriage, because if you don't have anything else that you share in terms of values or goals in life, all you share is that attraction, then that's not going to last very long. And we see that around in society, you know, all too often. The marriage is built just on attraction, do dissolve, unfortunately, very quickly. So that's we're trying to show the guy, you only attract her because of her looks. Look at her now. Do you feel any connection with her? I mean, she's not attractive right now. Was there anything else you connected on? Anything of substance? Or was it just a physical attraction? And if that's the case, why would you want to go ahead and marry her? It's not going to lead to anything good at the end. So that's one point. So we're discouraging the relationship based on this procedure. But there's a lot more which is said about this as well. So number one, we say that she has to sit there for 30 days mourning over the loss of her father and mother. Now, we don't know if her father and mother have been killed at battle, We don't know if they've been captured also, or maybe they're peaceful at home, but she's been captured, so she's lost her family. We don't know which one it is, but she's been cut off from her family. So we want to give her some time to adjust the situation. There's a few reasons for this. One reason is just humanitarian purposes. Even if the Torah is going to allow her to become a captive, just to say, okay, just forget your family, move on with life, we have to give her some time to adapt to her new situation. So there's 30 days which are designated. Leave her alone. Let her just come to peace with her current situation. Human beings are for better or for worse, we do adapt to our situation very fast. And at least she has that time. The Rambam says it's really an emotional need for her. To immediately just give up everything from her previous life and join the Jewish people is not possible. She needs that mourning period. Without it, it's very damaging for her. It wouldn't work. She wouldn't be able to adapt. Even if she wanted to convert. Because she's not ready for it, because she still has a whole lifetime behind her, which is on her mind. So she has to be given her time and space just to come to grips with her new situation. That's one point. The Ibn Ezra says that it's just considered proper and derech eretz to let someone mourn for their lost parents. It's just rational. How can the human being who just lost their parents make a move on with life? I mean, there's a reason that Jewish law has the idea of shiva. I'm supposed to have 30 days of mourning, we have a year of mourning, because you have to come to grips with these things in a gradual way. Sometimes it's very hard to know, as Jews, we have these built in. Non-Jews don't have rules like this, and people might lose a relative, God forbid, and be back at work a day or two later. And you wonder, like, how are they dealing with that emotional pain? How can you go back to life right away? It seems to be very difficult, because it's a big loss. So the Torah recognizes that people need time to come to grips with loss. And therefore, the evidence says it's derech eretz. It's just appropriate. It's just common sense to let her have time to mourn over the loss of her family. And additionally, we want her to know this is the appropriate thing to do as well. Meaning, if she's going to become a Jew, she has to develop the proper mitos of a Jew. And Jews recognize the value of kibud avim, honoring parents, and Jews know that we can't just cast off the loss of a parent, God forbid. So therefore, she has to, both from her own personal emotions and from our perspective that she may become Jewish, has to be trained in these good midos. She has to be trained that you can't just go on with life after losing a parent. You have to recognize that there's a big loss here, appreciate your parents, and come to grips with it. So that's the point made by the Ibn Ezra. The Ramban says an additional point. The Ramban says that she needs time to reject her previous religion. If she was worshiping idols 2 days before, now she's brought into a Jewish household. They're treating her nicely. I mean, she has to go through this hair-shaving procedure, but they're not tormenting her. They're feeding her, and she's living in the Jewish household. So if she wants to become Jewish, she has to reject her previous life. So many commentaries say, why you bring her into your own house? So we mentioned before, so you actually see her in her unattractive state and don't want to marry her. But other commentaries say you're trying to expose her to Jewish life. I mean, there is a chance here she will convert, and this man will marry her. And if we're trying to get her to convert, well, what's her exposure to Judaism? What's going to convince her? And really, if she's idolatrous, we'd like her to drop her idolatry. Because whether she wants to be Jewish or not, we don't believe in idol worship, that's for sure. So you bring her into your house, and you give her time to sit and experience a Jewish home, Jewish life, Jewish people around her. Learn what it's like to live as a Jew, and through that, she hopefully will come to reject idolatry, and maybe even come to accept Judaism. Okay. According to Rashi, it's forced upon her. According to Rambam, she can choose to. But ultimately, either way, you need her to be exposed to live as a Jew. Even according to Rashi, you can forcibly convert her. If she never experienced Jewish life, then what's she going to do when she goes Jewish? She's not going to do anything. So she has to at least have that exposure. So he takes her into her house. Number one, one hope is that he will no longer desire to marry her because she looks very unattractive at this point. And number two, we want her to be exposed to Jewish life in case he does marry her and she remains and becomes Jewish. So either way, we need her to be in the house. It's very reminiscent to me that when we were learning Megillas Rus, we discussed what is it that motivated Rus to want to become Jewish. And we spoke about it at the time. The only exposure she had was her connection with Naomi. Naomi, we know, was a person of great midos, great virtue, very kind and compassionate. And even though Rus never actually experienced other Jews besides her husband, who intermarried, who probably wasn't much of an observant Jew at that point, I assume, her whole exposure was to Naomi. Because she had that exposure, though, she was motivated to drop everything she had in Moab and become Jewish. So in my mind, you wonder if there's a similar goal happening with this Eshes Efas Torah, that we want her to see a proper Jewish home, let her experience Jews and Jewish life and people who have Jewish values, and maybe she'll actually appreciate it after a little bit of time and want to become Jewish, which is also a nice thing. So I can't help but at least sensing that in this procedure as well. So let's bring her into the house. So we have her. So her head's shaved, her nails grow out. She mourns for 30 days for her emotional needs, and also so she can drop idolatry. And then she's brought into the house during this procedure so that she can be exposed to Jewish life, and so the man can see her in an unattractive state. So that's all these steps. Rashi makes one additional point as well. Rashi says, "Kedei shetei bas Yisrael samecha." We want her to be a happy Jewish woman. I mean, we have a concept that Yivdus Hashem b'simcha, you should serve God in happiness. We look at being sad and depressed as a very, very terrible state. That's, I think the whole world understands that. And that's something that, and so certainly in Jewish life, somebody who's sad and depressed and down can't serve God properly and can't function properly. So if she is down and depressed about her situation, then even if she wants to become a Jew, she's not going to have the right attitude. She's going to be very, very down. She's going to be very, very, quiet or folk, whatever the depression may do to her. She's not going to be living a proper Jewish life if she's still depressed. So Rashi says these 30 days to mourn her parents are to heal her emotions so she can achieve a state of happiness if she becomes Jewish. Because we don't want her to come into being Jewish and being depressed simultaneously. We don't want that to occur. And without the time to heal emotionally, she can't achieve this. It's impossible. So we felt those 30 days are enough times she can heal at least to some degree that she can achieve a state of simcha. That's what Rashi says. The Torah then says that if you choose not to marry her, you can't sell her as a slave, and you also can't work her to make her your own slave. And it's two separate prohibitions. You can't sell her off, and you can't work her yourself. The truth is, the Torah does allow slavery. We've talked about that before, in the right context. And it wasn't uncommon for captives of war to become slaves. I think that was probably a main source of slavery in those times. But because you put her through this, you have no right to make her into a slave or make money off of her. You have to let her go free and let her go back to life as she wants. So, I mean, it seems in our minds kind of obvious why that would be, but let's just put it into words. The Sefer HaChinuch says, it's just derech eretz, it's just proper conduct. You took her in as a potential wife. He may have had an intimate relationship with her, so there was a connection made. And then just, it would be cruel at this point to say, okay, I've used you, I've tormented you, and now I'm selling you off as a slave, making you my own slave. That would be a pinnacle of cruelty. And even if he had to give in and take her into the house and go through the procedure, there was a line drawn in terms of how cruel it could be. So if you want to marry her, then that's an option. She'll be an actual normal wife, and you'll treat her like a wife with respect and with love. If you don't marry her, then you can't just work her as a slave. That would be cruelty. You have to free her. You have to let her go free. That's the Sefer HaChinuch. Now, other commentaries explain, the Abarbanel and others, they say this is actually partly a deterrent not to marry her. Meaning, we said this whole procedure is considered, a last resort. We don't like this procedure. It's a desperate measure for desperate times. So, in the back of everyone's minds, in those days at war, when they were capturing captives, was we can make money off these people. They'll have work, they'll go into slavery, and there's some sort of monetary gain involved. But the person knows, well, if I take her in as an Eshes Efas Torah, then I can't make any money off of her. Again, in our minds, it all sounds kind of out there and strange. But since we are discouraging this marriage in the first place, so we tell him, even though you might be attracted to her, realize that it's going to cause a possible loss of money. And people don't lose any money. Sometimes people's money is more important to them than their own desires. And therefore, it acts as a deterrent. They shouldn't even begin this procedure, because once you begin it, she can no longer be a slave or be sold as a slave. So those are all different points which come out in terms of Eshes Efas Torah. So I want to summarize, I think, a few different important lessons we get from this. Again, the procedure is very strange. It's kind of out there. It's not what we're used to. But I think in context, it makes a lot more sense, because we're dealing with somebody who already has lost it. The sin is going to occur. The question is, can we at least put a control on the out of control? The car is already going crazy. Can we at least put the brakes on to some degree? And that's the question. So this whole procedure is both to discourage him to actually marry her. That's one part of it. And it's at least to say, if you are going to keep her as a wife, she has to become a proper Jewish wife with the proper midos, and you have to develop there some form of relationship beyond her looks. Because if it's all about the looks, then it's not going to go. So we have, you know, wartime is often, you know, a lawless time where people do things which they wouldn't do in times of peace. We spoke about how the Jewish camp has to be full of purity, full of sanctity, and the people fighting the war were primarily tzaddikim, the righteous. That's number one. But the Torah recognizes human nature, that even people who try, even the righteous, are human beings. Nobody's infallible. Now, we don't believe anyone being infallible. Even, and as mentioned before, the greatest people, we do believe, have stronger yetzer hara sometimes. Now, their challenges can be greater than ours. And the challenges they have are real challenges. The Torah recognizes human nature. Judaism doesn't try to overlook human nature. The Torah tries to work with human nature. It tries to teach you how to harness human nature and use it appropriately. So this is a discussion of human nature, that there are times where people lose control of themselves based on their desires. So this mitzvah is to be able to channel and control that lust in a way which doesn't just become total immorality. There has to be something more to it. But it's definitely considered as Bedi Eved. It's not an ideal. It's not something which we would ever encourage to be done. It's just either way, like we said before, you're eating unhealthy meat. But you can eat kosher healthy meat, or you can eat chafin healthy meat. So but those are your choices, so it might as well be kosher unhealthy meat. That's how it's described. It's really a concession to the Yetzer Hara. You're conceding the Yetzer Hara. Now, as an aside, I've seen different Musar greats, you know, different commentaries discuss. There is an idea of sometimes trying to appease the Yetzer Hara. What I mean by that, like for instance, let's say that, you know, you really want to go out and, let's say, help somebody. An act of chesed. It's needed. You know, it's needed, and you're supposed to be there really soon. But you're really, really hungry. Right? So part of you says, well, someone else can do it. Like, I'm really hungry. I'll sit down and eat. The other part of you can say, well, let me grab a snack, and I'll be a little less hungry, and I'll eat later. A part of you can say that, you know what, I'll do the chesed, but later I'll have a really good dinner. Right? So in that way you can kind of appease the Yetzer Hara. The Yetzer Hara is trying to stop you. That hunger is trying to say, don't do the chesed, stay home and eat. But you say, okay, you know what, I was going to have a simple dinner, but you know what, I'll reward myself for the chesed I did, and I'm going to go out and buy myself a really nice dinner tonight. So then you'll do the chesed, but you'll give in to the Yetzer Hara, who is trying to push you to eat, but in a way which you're appeasing it so you can do what you need to do. So there are times where the Yetzer Hara needs to be appeased. You know, so you're not doing anything. You know, you can give into it to some degree and still do what's right. So I think this is also a source for that. Here you're giving into the Yetzer Hara, but yeah, the Torah is conceding the Yetzer Hara, but yeah, it's giving it a way in which we can at least channel it in the right direction. Ultimately, this mitzvah speaks a lot about what Jewish marriage is supposed to be. It's discussing the idea of discouraging the relationship. It's not a good relationship. This will not work. And it's something I think in modern times amongst many is lost, which is that, you know, we talk about the concepts, it's in modern culture, let's say, you know, love at first sight. So what does that mean? It means that there's attraction, physical attraction, that's all it means, love at first sight. People very often, they will connect based on physical attraction, but there's no shared values, there's no shared vision, there's nothing emotional which is shared there. And that marriage, it's based on infatuation, but there's no real connection. So what happens to marriage like that? So either they eventually develop that connection, but if they don't, those marriages are doomed to failure. That's the reality of life. A marriage is built on shared values, on a sense of emotional connection, so and the attraction is there, but that's not what it's built upon. That's a very healthy marriage, because then there's something to sustain it, you know, as time goes on. So Torah is saying, you know, the soldier attracted at war to a non-Jewish woman who's attractive. That's not a recipe for any sort of marriage of sanctity in Jewish life. It's not going to work. It's going to lead to definitely issues in the household, if not a divorce. And then Rashi says it's going to lead to kids who are rebellious, because when kids see parents who aren't getting along, it impacts the kids as well. It's very, if the home is not peaceful, then the kids aren't peaceful. You know, it goes both ways. So this mitzvah ultimately is discouraging the entire thing from happening. This mitzvah is there to say, what you're doing is wrong. It's not going to lead to anything good. We understand you can't control yourself, but realize that you shouldn't continue. Now, the truth is, if she cleanses off her own personal past, if she decides, I'm in this beautiful Jewish home, And even though I used to live in this foreign country and I was an idolater and I lived a very different lifestyle, but you know, I've been exposed to a different world over here. And this world has charmed me, has enchanted me. And I want to be Jewish, so then suddenly they're going to share values with one another. Right? If the procedure actually goes through to the end and he still wants to marry her and she converts, so then the Torah is looking at it as if at this point there is some way to develop a real relationship beyond the attraction. Now the marriage could succeed. But without this, the marriage cannot succeed. So she sits there, and she's supposed to purify herself, have her own immoral past, or her own idolatrous past, be inspired by Jewish life. And through that, she should become worthy of being a Jewish wife in a Jewish household. So that's the alternative option over here. Again, that's not even the one that's encouraged, because that's unlikely. What's likely is that he won't want to marry her. He realized what he did was foolish, and you know, that was a loss of his own control, and he'll set her free, which is also fine. And for her, it's probably better than remaining a slave at the end of the day. So I assume that she probably benefits from that. Yeah.
So if it goes to the end where she converts full-heartedly and they have the same values,
yeah,
are there still rebellious children, or it's considered a different woman in a sense?
So it's interesting, because the way that Rashi describes it, you know, if you keep her around, you will come to hate her, and then you will have rebellious children. But in my mind, it probably depend upon, was she forcibly converted? Did she willingly convert? Because if she really becomes a sincere convert, then you wonder, why would that lead to rebellious children? So Rashi is the one who says that he forcibly could convert her. So we understand that could lead to rebellious children. So maybe Rashi is all going on the same line of understanding. Any other questions? Okay, so that's the Ishus Yefas Tohar. Again, we call it one of the more obscure mitzvahs that we have. But you put it in the context, I think a lot of it does fit in and make a lot of sense.